Thanks very much, Andrew. It's great to see so many is here. How we got to come to this lecture? When I was doing the research, it was a lot to be getting through, and one of my supervisors was Mary O'Dowd, and Professor Mary O'Dowd, should I say, and she said to me, "This is all very well and good, Jim, but where's the women's section?" And I was like, "Mary, there's an awful lot to be getting through here. I've got logistics, I've got firepower, I've got the military revolution, I've got violence and bloodshed and terrible things. I don't really have the room," and she looked at me very unimpressed and said, "Well, I hope you're going to do it at some point." So hopefully at some point this is me making good. Now, some of this has been seen, heard before once or twice, but there's a second act, the horrible second act, which hasn't been seen before, and hopefully I know what I'm talking about. If I don't, please tell me, but this is the first time run out, so let's hope it goes well. But anyway, we'll kick off in it and we'll see how we go. Okay, now the 9 years' war in Ireland, also known as Tyrone's Rebellion, visited death, devastation and misery to every province in the country and brought the English regime in Ireland to teetering on the point of collapse. However, after 10 years, yes, it's 10 years, it's the 9 years' war, ask me after, I'll let you know. Tyrone and his Irish allies were defeated and the Tudor conquest of Ireland was completed. Now, the final vestiges of native Irish power and social order were swept away. But oddly, there's been relatively little written on the subject and what is a pivotal moment in Irish history. And only in the last decade have scholars really turned their attention to the conflict. And even then, many of the narratives still refer to publications written almost 70 years ago. So then consider the women of this war. Until very recently, the history of women in early modern armies has received scant attention. Therefore, for an obscure conflict on the edge of Europe, the history of women in Ireland during Tyrone's war against the English crown is all but non-existent. The figure of Queen Elizabeth may have been the apex of the English state. However, the state papers and annals relating to the war gave little attention to the role of women during the conflict. Look at the state of that. Okay, you've got Elizabeth up there, the lovely Armada portrait. And then after that, it's all Y chromosomes. Look at the state. They're all the big shots. They're all men. Nothing of women. Absolutely nothing at all. But war was, according to the sources, war was clearly the prerogative of men, or so the current history would suggest. But close scrutiny reveals enough to show that women were not passive observers to the conflict, but vital element to both the English and Irish campaigns. This presentation will explore the presence of women in campaigns and what part they play in what could be a decidedly harsh existence. And for the first time, this lecture will also be looking at gender violence, so it'll get quite dark near the end, so bear with me. Now, in contemporary Europe, women were a common, indeed indispensable, feature of life on campaign. Recruitment of soldiers was invariably associated with an influx of civilians, notably women, children, and service providers, such as sutlers, who could always be, also be women. This is actually sole supplies of soldiers. And the numbers following an army could vary in size, but in many cases, they could equal or even greatly outnumber the troops in the field. Women performed many domestic tasks commonly associated with civilian life, such as washing, cooking and cleaning. And prostitution in various guises serviced the sexual desires of the troops, and medical needs were often met by nurses attached to the army or established in areas of operations. Unsurprisingly, Ireland was no different, and armies operating in Ireland had the same needs as any other contemporary force. Therefore, supporting entourages of civilians were present. However, identifying the exact numbers of accompanying the troops into the field is problematic, as those writing the reports weren't officially responsible for their maintenance, nor was it an issue if they were killed or died on what campaign. Essentially, if you're not paying for them, who really cares? Even so, many women and children followed the English troops into the field from the opening stages of the war. Captain Humphrey Willis's foray into Fermanagh during the spring of 1593, with a single company of foot, and this is about 90 men, was accompanied by 160 women and boys, all living upon the spoil of the country. Now, among the women associated with early modern armies, invariably some catered to the sexual needs of the soldiers. Prostitution was a common feature of military camps in Europe and was generally tolerated, but the attitudes to ostensibly immoral behaviour within the army camp mirrored attitudes within civil society. English officers were known to order prostitutes out of the camp, though with limited success. Anthony Reynolds' moral outrage was unmistakable when reacting to allegations in Derry in 1601. Now, Reynolds, who was the muster master of the English garrison, this is the guy who generally counted up how many troops were there to be paid. He's quite an unpopular character. Was indignant that two captains, knowing me to be in the preacher's house alone with the maid of the house, spread scandalous reports of me having been found there accompanied by a whore, and reported to the governor, this is Sir Henry Dockery, who jested of it to me myself, which is basically taking a hand at him, but in spite of Dockery, took less than a light-hearted tone in a letter to the English Privy Council just 4 days later, where he condemned the troops for their vice and reported that thefts, whoredoms are daily practiced and seldom punished. And while moral impropriety was clear to officers, the trade in sex was tolerated rather than condoned. There are a few clues to the scope of the sexual commerce within the Irish camps. Yes, they're not much more polite. They're not all tripping off to mass while these perfidious Albion types having their moral perpetuated. Anyway, the Archdeacon De Herberna Insula Commentaries, published in 1632, the Archbishop of Armagh, Peter Lombard, claimed that Tyrone took an uncompromising stance on sexual conduct both in civil society and in the army, which is actually a bit hypocritical considering he had so many bits on the side. But different rules. The Earl banned and implemented harsh penalties for concubinage and enforced the same order in his military camps, and the weight of the laws fell upon the women who were subject to exile, whipping, or deforming of their faces by branding or slitting. Notwithstanding the Earl's prescriptions, there is little reason to assume that Tyrone had any more success than the Crown in eradicating sexual impropriety from the army. And while the authorities in Dublin did not concern themselves with the fate of camp followers, the masses of humanity which followed the armies needed fed nonetheless, and consequently the Crown was beset by reports of disorder and theft caused by Crown troops passing through loyal territories, and the cost of maintaining women and children in the camp was borne by the soldiers who brought them. Despite express orders from Dublin to the contrary, troops extorted money and supplies from the rural population. And while this practice raised much discontent and complaints from the territories affected, the association of large numbers of civilians with armies caused major problems for effective military operations. Though, as we said, vital for day-to-day maintenance of the camp, civilians could have a drastic effect on the tactical and operational effectiveness of armies. Because remember, armies are actually there to fight, but they can only march as fast as their slowest member of the column. So essentially they slowed down and really restricted the mobility of armies across the landscape. Within the restrictive Irish landscape and against their elusive, fast-paced Irish enemies, this was a huge handicap for the English. Now, Lord Deputy Russell attempted to limit the numbers to but six women for laundresses, such as shall be married wives to some of the said soldiers. Of course they'll be married, no allegations here. Now Russell threatened to execute any civilians found over and above the permitted number permitted by martial law. And there was exceptional provisions. These were exceptional provisions, and it's unclear how Russell ever thought they could be enforced, as the rule of law required these self-same troops to enforce it. Moreover, the Lord General of the Army, Sir John Norreys, refused the Count to sign the orders, and ultimately Russell's orders had no effect. Now, there are written reports, and it would be going a wee bit too far to say many, but there are some referring to women in English military camps, but there is only one illustration showing women in an English camp, or Irish camp for that matter, during the war. And this was the illustration showing the siege of Glynn Castle in County Limerick in July 1600. And at the bottom of the drawing is the camp, and it was occupied by an assortment of soldiers, typical of English armies, but also three women are shown. It's a bit closer up. Now, one walks through the central avenue of the camp, apparently accompanied by what could be an officer, whereas another two women walk together unaccompanied. They seem to be at their leisure. Moreover, their dress suggests that they were women of some status. Their full-length dresses were adorned with highly fashionable whisk-standing collars, and siege camps were regularly noted for their squalor and disease. But evidently, women of means were willing to accompany troops to such places. I've actually read all the accounts of Glynn, doesn't say anything about the women. This is the only thing to say that they were there. Now, wives and camp followers are not the sole provenance of English units. Women joined Tyrone's men on campaign. However, early Irish operations relied on speed, which would not have been concomitant with civilians or baggage to slow their pace. However, during the latter stages of the war, Tyrone's Confederate forces were forced to bring supply trains, and at the same time, reports appear noting the presence of women in the Irish camps. Now, capture by the crown appeared to have little impediment to Irish women who wished to be with their husbands. And after the Confederate garrison of Listowel Castle, County Kerry, surrendered in December 1600, their wives were released. However, the women did not leave but returned to the English camp to be with their husbands. They lodged with them in the night, all night, at the Marshalsea, which was a type of prison, and there they stayed till noon. Actually, the story ends a bit bad. They stayed till noon, and then you find out in Sir George Carew's papers that when he finds out that the troops were spared, he went, "This is it," and has them all executed anyway. Not the women, just their husbands. Now, civilians attending the army were generally drawn from the lower social classes, but there were cases where women of high social standing travelled with the army. And Catherine McGuinness, Tyrone's fourth wife, was with him in camp in South Armagh in 1597. Now, a nighttime camisade forced Catherine, which is a nighttime attack, fancy word for it, nighttime camisade forced Catherine and her husband to flee into the woods, but the experience did not deter her, as 2 years later, Catherine was with Tyrone in camp near Newry. Moreover, McGuinness was 4 months pregnant at the time, and at the end of October, she gave birth to a son, Sean. When Tyrone was near Navan, County Meath, at the end of 1599, Sir William Warren reported that Tyrone had his wife, which, by the way, was less than a month after giving birth to her son, so she was like a special type of hard. He noted that his wife and daughters in the camp with him, and with some pessimism, Warren added that, for the most part, all their wives are with them. This is all the Irish wives, which maketh me think that they regard our army but a little. In other words, they didn't really think they had that much to fear from the English. And true enough, in 1599, they really didn't. Now, while women were unquestionably caught up in the horrors of war and were often present during engagements, there is little to suggest that they actively took part in combat. Women were recorded as holding fortified positions, such as Hugh McGuinness's wife at Narrowwater. Now, Catherine Butler also held two wards in 1601, and though it's perhaps unsurprising to find that she was paid the lowest rate of any constable on the Crown list. Lucky her. Some things don't change. There are no surviving accounts of women taking an active role in battle during the Nine Years' War. There is one incident recorded where a desperate measure to deceive the enemy, and during the dying stages of the war, a few of the Earl of Tyrone's allies still held out against the Crown. Two of these were Donald Cam O'Sullivan Bear and Kilconnock Maguire, who continued to resist English operations in Fermanagh at the start of 1603. Now, a superior English force discovered O'Sullivan's camp while the bulk of the Irish forces were away on a raid. Therefore, O'Sullivan armed the camp's women and children, making the force seem stronger than it was. It's said that O'Sullivan placed his armed men in front, the sutlers to the rear, and the boys and women holding long staves for spears. He placed as if in reserve, so as to frighten the enemy, as if by show of numbers. And the ruse worked, and the English withdrew. Participation of women in combat may have been extremely limited, but this does not mean that they did not commit acts of violence. In later centuries, Irish women are reported to have participated in mob violence to the extent that they could display levels of aggression and brutality that matched their male counterparts. And correspondingly, it would be fairly safe to assume that women took part in the tumultuous overthrow of the Munster plantation in 1598, with all its attendant brutality. However, women were rarely specifically implicated in murder. Very few sketchy cases. There's one I actually found of that's in detail, where essentially they set this guy up. She invited a guy around for dinner. She was Gaelic Irish. He was English, which suggests a sort of level of trust anyway. Then, out of earshot, she says he said something untoward, and our three brothers piled in and murdered the guy. It absolutely stinks, but it doesn't actually go into any details of what further happened. But no actual direct attacks by women. However, leave it to Fiennes Morrison to provide the most gruesome and lurid descriptions of violence by women. In his account of the famine in Ulster in 1602-03, he referred to old women preying on children, and he recounted how some old women of those parts used to make a fire in the fields, and diverse little children driving out their cattle in the cold mornings and coming thither to warm them were surprised, killed and eaten. One girl managed to escape and raised the alarm, bringing soldiers who promptly put the women to the sword. And this event has frequently been cited as evidence of the deplorable state of Ulster by 1602-03, but the incident is far too fantastic to be true. Think about it, just think about it. Now, this has appeared in so many accounts talking about, especially when it's famine in Ireland, this always appears. But stop and deconstruct it for a second. Why did the women just not take the cows? Furthermore, the icon of the cannibalistic crone is a stock feature in folkloric tales of early modern Europe. Morrison may have added this to his narrative as a dramatic flourish to what is already a decidedly monotonous but brutal phase of the war. Furthermore, he may have created this story as a metaphor for the barbarism of the Irish, something that Morrison already missed a chance to emphasise. It's Hansel and Gretel, essentially. That's what it is. If you break it down, it's Hansel and Gretel. That's all. Now, war was never just a matter of soldiers, armies, soldiers and combat. Fighting and bleeding and the misery found in campaign trail may provide the most shocking and therefore most dramatic narratives of the war. But just in today's modern high-tech wars, information and intelligence was key to guiding decision-making for both sides. And it is in this sphere that women played a significant, if less recognised, role, appearing regularly as spies and informants. It would be foolish to assume that women were not paying attention to the actions and speeches of the men about the course and conduct of the war, even if they were not directly involved or played an active part in those events. Consequently, when women fell into government hands or fled to them for their protection, they often had vital and hugely enlightening pieces of intelligence, even if the importance of that information could only be gauged in hindsight. In 1593, a small addendum to an intelligence report to Burley noted that English troops had found a woman who reported that Tyrone, O'Donnell and Maguire had recently secretly met, and that the Earl had ordered Maguire not to engage with the English army and not to advance or the loss of his men, but hold them in reserve till the Queen's army were dissolved. They got tired and went away. Now, the informant's veracity could not be guaranteed at the time, but later events demonstrated that she was clearly telling the truth. Maguire did indeed refuse to be drawn into the crown, failed to engage the Irish main force during the 1593 campaign in Fermanagh. She was absolutely telling the truth, but without a level of support or trust in the informant, they just went, all right, that's fine. And then only in retrospect, when we look at how events unfolded, that was exactly what happened. She was telling the truth, probably on the threat of terrible things happening here. Now, other women provided detailed reports which, if acted upon at the time, may have greatly changed the entire course of the conflict. The earliest of these was Joan Kelly. She was brought up at the Earl of Tyrone's household in Dungannon, but married an English soldier, whom she accompanied to on the relief expedition to resupply Enniskillen in 1594. The force was attacked and routed by the Irish under Hugh Maguire at the Battle of the Ford of the Biscuits on the 7th of August. And she was shot in the arm but was rescued by one of Tyrone's Scottish mercenaries, who Kelly had known before the war. She was detained for several days before being released, and it took months after the event for the government officers to interrogate Kelly, but her declaration was taken by Sir Henry Duke, who had actually commanded forces that were routed by Maguire. Now, she provided a detailed description of Tyrone's complicity in the attack on the English army, and his meeting with Maguire at Liscallaghan, actually modern-day five-mile town, just 15 miles northeast of the battle. Now, I might add, by this time, actually, they still think Tyrone is on the English side. He's all going, this is terrible, what's happening with Maguire? This is awful, what's happening with Maguire? And O'Donnell as well. Don't worry, I'll sort it out for you lads. Because this is the guy who's called the Queen's Earl. He's bought and paid for it. I think he's their guy. But they don't actually know that the only reason Maguire can even get into the field of fight in the first place is because he sent them all the troops. So he's playing both sides very effectively. Now, Kelly gives details of Tyrone's plans to go to the Lord Deputy Russell, his receipt of equipment and horses that were captured at the Battle of the Ford of the Biscuits, and Tyrone had given orders for the spoiling of Breffni and the Peel. In addition, she gave the names of many senior and junior officers in Tyrone's camp, and despite the damning evidence, it took Tyrone's capture of the Blackwater in February 1595 for the Crown to finally concede that the Earl was complicit in the war. She had blown the gaff on all of them, the detail list. She gave every... There was four squires, senior, junior officers, the lot who was injured, who was at the meeting at Liscallaghan, what was handed over, like four graven armours, four blackened armours, six horses, the lot, she gave everything. And it's only like, what, 5 months later, they go, oh, right. But if they had actually went, oh, right, that's fine, they would have just... arrested Tyrone, and probably would have all ended, but then I wouldn't be talking to you here. Now, some women were more business-minded with their intelligence. Anne Wilmar was the handmaid to Mabel Bagnall, Tyrone's third wife, and after Mabel's death, this is in 15, Mabel died in 1585, Wilmar made the return to England. But she first arrived at Kilmacthomas Castle, County Waterford. Living at the heart of Tyrone's lordship, she would have been privy to a wealth of information. And Wilmar suggested that the Queen would be willing to pay £10,000 for her knowledge of Tyrone's movements in the Peel and who he was meeting. There was no suggestion that Wilmar received the sum, or if this was idle speculation to extract cash from the crown, but it's obvious that she knew that in war, crucial information could demand, or in her case, suggest, exorbitant sums. Though some women were caught by circumstances, others actively put themselves in danger to gather intelligence. In his efforts to track down James Fitzthomas, the Sugan Earl of Desmond, this is one of Tyrone's key allies in Munster, Milo McGrath, the Protestant Archbishop of Cashel, controlled 17 spies, which he described as men and women dispersed throughout Munster in disguised manner, some like fools, others lame, and counterfeit blind jesters. After Ony O'Muir captured the Earl of Ormond in April 1600, the Secretary of State of Ireland, Sir Geoffrey Fenton, managed to have a gentlewoman placed in the same lodgings as the imprisoned Earl. From there, she passed details of Ormond's captivity and brought messages to the Earl from Fenton and Mountjoy. We never learned the true name of Fenton's gentlewoman, as she was initially called Honora, and was later given the rather intriguing codename Imperia Romana. For all her good efforts to maintain communications, which she did thoroughly, at very much risk to herself, she maintained communications to Ormond and the state during his imprisonment. Now, Ormond never saw fit to mention her in his letters after his release in June 1600. Well, that's gratitude for you. Now, Tyrone was credited with having an excellent intelligence on his English adversaries, and at the start of 1595, Lord Deputy Russell noted that Tyrone knew about the order to send fresh troops out of England before he did, and that Tyrone could hear anything out of England sooner than the deputy, his words. According to the polemical Discourse on the Mere Irish of Ireland, the author remarked how women played a key part in gathering intelligence, noting that in times of hostility, these women do serve for espials to give all possible intelligence to the enemy of any project intended against them. Consequently, it was highly likely that women were an integral part to Tyrone's intelligence network. Now, during the wars of the mid-17th century, Irish women often acted as messengers and diplomatic go-betweens, taking advantage of familial and social ties to transmit communications and mediate between men on both sides of the conflict. This was also seen during the Nine Years' War, but while some were elite noblewomen, there were also many references to nameless women carrying dispatches. Indeed, the anonymous author of Discourse on the Mere Irish suggested that women formed the core of the communications network, which carried news and letters throughout Ireland. And while railing against what they called a roughish kind of people, some were stout beggars, some were professed whores, and other common women, the discourse referred to the women as itinerant messengers and letter carriers. In times of trouble, women be the instrument that do whisper them at all times from one to another of all the Irish faction. These be the conduits that carry and convey these evils from place to place, and do divulge and scatter this reprobate opinion in every corner of the kingdom, and these do join these firebrands together. This was how the Irish lords were talking to each other. The author goes further, claiming that the women also acted as spies and saboteurs, likely to burn down houses or villages which, through compassion or charity, they were given shelter, though this might simply be an attack on Irish women, a common practice at the time. It is clear that women carried letters and messages for both the English and Irish throughout the war. Moreover, they might have been able to do so in greater safety than men performing the same role. When the Earl of Essex attempted to agitate defections in Ulster in 1599, he was careful to send a woman because a man should have been suspected. In Munster, Florence McCarthy noted that the letters sent by Sir George Carew during the summer of 1600 would have cost the messenger his life if it had been taken by the Irish along the way. And McCarthy's replies to Carew and the Earl of Thomond were all hidden and stitched in women's apparel. Clearly, women could actually move along the roads in some level of safety greater than men. Often women adopted roles that were far more active than a basic functionary for delivering letters or messages. They were often used by both the Crown and Irish Confederacy's envoys or representatives, and wives of senior leaders could attend meetings on their husband's stead. During the discussions with Sir John Norris in 1597, Tyrone specifically requested that Faye McHugh O'Byrne send his wife, Rose, to represent his interests. And possibly to avoid questions of whether their loyalty, wives could be used as proxies. Fear that direct contact with enemies may suggest complicity may have been behind Lord Delvin's request for the Irish Council, this is the Irish Privy Council, to grant his wife a commission to parley with the Irish rebels. Throughout Europe, women wielded indirect political power by influencing their husbands or male relatives to whom official authority was vested. The same was true in Ireland, but in the context of the divisions between the native Irish, Old English and New English. Many of the English establishment had bewailed the impact of intermarriage on English culture in Ireland long before the outbreak of the war in 1593. There were efforts to ban intermarriage between Irish and English families in 1538, though with little success. As there were frequent accusations by the English arrivals in Ireland that the Catholic Old English had degenerated due to social contact and intermarriage with native Irish. And in his report to the English Privy Council, Lord Chancellor Gerard called for the prohibition of intermarriage as a key feature of English degenerates. Nevertheless, by 1593, this was still a matter of grave concern for the Crown. Now, Edmund Spenser, great English literist, summarised the issues by cataloguing the dangers of Irish wives. He levelled a litany of dangers and cited examples such as the Birminghams, who through licentious conversion with the Irish, or marrying or fostering, were now waxing most savage of the Irish. He called fostering and marriage the two most dangerous infections, and English children brought up by the Irish nurses or mothers will always be inclined to favour the Irish speech and manners. Clearly there was an issue with the Irish language, even back during the 9 Years' War. The anonymous author of the Dialogue of Sylvan and Peregrine penned similar concerns. And in the Supplication of the Blood of the English Most Lamentably Murdered in Ireland, which essentially this polemic written in 1598, possibly by Spenser, though it actually gets into such dark places that even Spenser wouldn't put his name on it, added that Irish wives could draw their husbands to ignore their duty, protect Irish relatives in revolt, and even coerce their spouses to defect or surrender their wards or castles into Irish hands. Now, Irish wives changed the English in name to Irish in nature. Whew, strong stuff. And the loss of Athy Castle in November 1598 may have confirmed fears that the loyalty of garrisons could be compromised by intermarriage. The constable and 14 of his warders, who, by the way, were all English or Anglo-Irish, defected to the Irish. Sir Richard Bingham suggested it was because the constable had married into the O'Moores, and by this he was drawn to be a villain. Despite claims that Irish wives had harmful, if not malevolent, influences on English officers, the taking of the Blackwater Fort by Art McBryan O'Neill in February 1595 demonstrated that Irish wives could occupy a role as mediator between Crown and Irish. When the Irish directed an envoy to negotiate the surrender of the fort, the commander of the fort sent out one of his warders' wives, who was a friend of Art McBryan O'Neill, to know further his mind, we thinking that she could persuade him to consent to our demands, which was a 24-hour ceasefire, and she could also carry messages between the defenders of two isolated sections of the fort. Didn't actually work out in the end. They just went, listen, either leave the fort or we're burning it to the ground. Just went, right, lads. But they all got home safely. They all got sent to Newry. Everything was good. O'Neill was raging. There were so many people shot around the fort. He was like, kill them all. And Art went, no, we've made a deal. Off they go. That's a different story. There were references to the Irish wives drawing away formerly loyal lords. And Ormond claimed that it was the Baron of Kerry's link to Viscount Mountgarret that caused him to rebel against the crown. Mountgarret was allied to Tyrone, and Ormond claimed that Kerr was simple and foolish, carried away by his wife. That was Mountgarret's sister. Wives also exerted a strong influence on the Irish Confederates, and in many instances forced or convinced their husbands to defect to the crown. Certainly, the wishes of a lord's spouse could be a decisive factor. In Connacht, John Burke joined Tyrone, but was persuaded to return his allegiance to the crown on the intercession of his wife and his mother. Further, it was alleged that Florence McCarthy's wife, Ellen, refused to share his bed until he reconciled himself with the English. But he reconciled himself very quickly, by the way. The power of wives to influence their husbands was not lost on the English officers in Ireland, and a key feature of Mountjoy's efforts to defeat Tyrone's confederation was a more determined effort to cause defections in the Irish ranks. The best documented success was the plot to entice Dermot O'Connor's defection. He was one of Tyrone's principal captains in Munster, but O'Connor's wife Margaret was the sister of James Fitzgerald, a claimant to the vacant earldom of Desmond and held prisoner in the Tower of London. If Margaret could cause her husband to betray James Fitzthomas, the Sugan Earl of Desmond, Carew offered to have her brother reinstated as the Earl of Desmond. Carew was unambiguous when he wrote, "The chiefest motive that draws him," that is O'Connor, "to the Queen is the persuasion of his wife, who works him to no other end than to enlarge her brother." Although the £1,000 offered by the Lord President might have sweetened the deal. Ultimately, the plotters bungled this complex plan, and the fiasco resulted in O'Connor's death, but Carew made sure to look after Margaret, and she was later granted £100 per annum as a pension. Bad for O'Connor, grand for Margaret. Now, warfare in Ireland is replete with examples of mistreatment or direct attacks on civilians. Now, before the 9 Years' War, civilian victimisation and brutality are found in both the First and Second Desmond Wars. The vicious campaigns conducted by Sir Humphrey Kilbert, that's Sir Walter Raleigh's half-brother, in Munster became a byword for brutality and cruelty. Moreover, Gilbert was renowned for his harsh treatment of old women. According to the contemporary English author, Sir Thomas Churchard, the men of war could not be maintained without their churls, their calliacs, or their women, who milked their crates, that's the herds of cattle, and provided their victuals and other necessaries, so that killing of them by the sword was the way to kill the kill the men of war by famine. So clearly, gender was not going to give you any sex being female was not any protection from Gilbert. Clearly, gender was not going to provide any protection or immunity from aggression in the wars against the Irish. However, despite criticism of Irish women, there is little evidence to suggest that they were targeted. This is in the 9 Years' War. There's little evidence to say they were targeted because they were women. It is clear that wild women were killed along with men and children in Ireland. It's also occurred in France and the Low Countries, and indeed the brutality inflicted on women in Ireland during the war was part of general victimisation of civilians and not specifically directed according to gender. In Europe, the situation was worse, far worse. Reports of attacks on women in the Low Countries and France were frequent and graphic. Gratuitous violence against women was a characteristic of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in Paris in 1572, and women fared no better in the Dutch Revolt, where rape was commonplace. This was also not just during the large-scale ransacking of towns, such as Antwerp in 1576, but also at a local level in rural districts. An account of a woman tortured to reveal the whereabouts of her money had an unmistakable sexual element, and though she was not physically raped, the behaviour of the soldiers was intended to cause sexual degradation and humiliation. Sexual violence was, and unfortunately is, still a common aspect of war and has a long history, which included attacks not only upon women but also upon men and children. However, during the 9 Years' War, there is little evidence to suggest that rape, sexually motivated assault or gender violence was a major issue. The Crown was always ready to seize upon any atrocity to paint the Irish as base and brutal. Therefore, instances of rape and sexual assault would have undoubtedly been exploited by the Crown to demonise the Irish Confederates and smear Tyrone's reputation. In general, rape was rarely mentioned during the war, and this can be explained by one of two reasons. It was not either one, it was not widely reported because it was not common, or there was a failure to comment by both sides of the conflict, or there was a failure of reporting, women wouldn't come forward. Rape was a serious crime in both English and Native Irish Breton law. Now, Russell orders for the army in 1596 stated that soldiers would be put to death for ravishing or carnal knowledge of any woman against her will. And similarly, in Irish law, it was an offence but punished by a system of fines and compensation. However, investigation of rape in early modern Europe is no easy feat, as there's a remarkable paucity of material to work with. And in a study of women in the Irish Wars of the 1640s, Mary O'Dowd suggested that shame and humiliation associated with rape ensured in many cases were left unreported. But during the 9 Years' War, in a draft response to Tyrone in 1600, an unsigned author referred to the brutalities of the war in terms of robberies, murders, extinguishing of families, burning of houses, and all kinds of bloody licentiousness and cruelty. Now, this sentence was later amended by the Lord High Treasurer in London, Lord Brookhurst, to include the word rapes. alteration what was already a strong rebuke of Tyrone suggested that despite all the savagery and destruction seen in 7 years of war, sexual violence was not frequent enough to warrant mention. And where it was noted, it was always as a general sense with little elaboration or description of specific cases. Where rape was mentioned, there was rarely any detail provided. Assaults on women were usually mentioned in general terms. The first reference to rape of the war came from Spencer, who described the Irish as common ravishers of women and murderers of children. However, the first specific allegation was by the Earl of Ormond against the O'Moores and the O'Connors of Leinster, and he claimed that they had abused men's wives and their daughters in such a villainous manner as it is not to be spoken. Now Tyrone, this is to Tyrone's face, and Tyrone denied the accusation, but Jones claimed that the Leinster Irish had even been caused disorders in Ulster, and annotated in the margins of the manuscript that the inhabitants of Tyrone have vowed to cut their throats if they come there. After bringing the ringleaders into Tyrone's presence, the Earl was unable to defend his ally's actions, causing him to grow into a rage, partly against those rascals themselves, and partly because he was so strictly charged for them. This is what happens once they do find out, once they have a case they can prove and show, they lose no time in confronting Tyrone with it. There was one case of rape in which some details survived. This was an attack on a woman in Limerick in 1601, and it was reported that Thomond's men ravished the aged and decrepit woman. Now, Thomond was actually on the English side of the incident was only mentioned in the state papers as part of a reason for not paying the Earl of Thomond's foot company. While detailed descriptions of specific attacks were rare but not known, the dialogue of Sylvian and Peregrine recounted how Teig McMurrah threatened to torture an English woman in Killucan, County Westmeath. After dying in Redmond Friend's Victual in House, McMurrah allegedly demanded 40 shillings from his wife, but she refused, claiming they had none, and McMurrah threatened to roast her upon a spit at the fire, upon which the English couple relented and gave their unwelcome guests what little money they had in the house. It was possible that these were isolated cases and not representative of the relationship between the Irish Confederates and civilians of the Peel. And only during the Munster Revolt in 1598 did allegations of rape and sexual violence become more frequent. And the plantation of Protestant settlers from England was overthrown almost overnight by a popular insurrection of the native Irish. The thing is about this revolt is that it wasn't under the control of Tyrone or his allies. They'd only just entered the county, and basically the lower orders, the churls, for want of a better word, because they're not really peasants, rose up, and essentially the rebellion, this revolt, had actually reached the edges of Munster before Tyrone's troops were 10 miles inside Munster. The entry of the Irish Confederate troops into Munster precipitated widespread attacks on English settlers, leading to outrages and atrocities that were not a feature of the war to that point. Lurid and descriptive accounts were recorded in the Supplication of the Blood of the English, and it claimed that the Irish attacked women of almost any age, even children of 12 or 11, as none that lighted into their Irish hands escaped their beastly lust. The polemic quality of the supplication was unmistakable and may have been exaggerated to elicit a strong response from England. And despite this, other sources suggested that the level of violence exhibited in Munster was greater than elsewhere. There were many cases where massacre and execution took little account of the sex of those killed. After the fall of Enniskillen in 1594, Captain John Dowdall had 30 to 40 women and children murdered in cold blood. O'Sullivan Burr described how English troops threw the women and children to their deaths at Dersey Island, County Cork, in 1602. And Captain Flower reportedly killed as many women and children that fell and that he could find, whereas Sir Arthur Chichester, this is Belfast's founder, frequent attacks on civilians are well documented. Both the English and Irish alike condemned the other for killing civilians, but both sides were known to kill women and children. However, there is some evidence to suggest that the Crown troops were more prone to attack civilians than the Irish Confederates. After his lands were devastated in 1598, Lord Roche, and this is in County Cork, noted that the Irish tended to destroy churches and mansions and spoil land, whereas the English troops spoiled my tenants and killed both men, women and children. So clearly there's a difference of behaviour. It's difficult to assess the frequency of attacks on women. Limited references make assessments based solely on a small amount of reported cases, but consequently it's worth highlighting the overall levels of brutality and violence prevalent in the war by examining the manifestation of refugees during the conflict. Civilian flight was often associated with the breakdown of social order or economic collapse. And in his study on the effects of early modern warfare in England and continental Europe, Quentin Utram posited that relatively peaceful, non-violent relations between belligerents and civilian populations could be observed by the lack of large-scale refugee migrations. When applied to the war in Ireland, it is evident that instances of civilian flight were few, and associated with major breakdowns of civilian order, agricultural collapse, or in response to deliberate targeting of civilian populations. Though the war started in 1593, large numbers of refugees first occurred in 1598 during the collapse of the Munster Plantation, which initially was far more of an insurrection by the common Irish than a military operation ordered by Tyrone. Later, the scorched earth tactics by the Lord Deputy Mountjoy in 1600-02 forced civilians to abandon their homes in large numbers. But for most of the war, relations between civilians and soldiers never really deteriorated to the point where the civilian population felt obliged to abandon their lands. So Richard Bingham noted that while the Irish Confederates dominated much of the Irish countryside by the end of 1598, the people neither fear nor fly the rebels. This suggests that the conflict had more in common with the restraint of the English Civil War than the untrammeled brutality that would later be seen in the 30 Years' War. Now, quickly to sum up, because I have to, this conflict convulsed every part of Ireland and caused untold amounts of misery. That I'm not trying to say that at all. But inevitably the impact of the war fell on both men and women. It's not like just one side fought the war and the other side did nothing. And regardless of the decidedly male bias narrative, the relative lack of representation in the manuscripts and contemporary publications, women were intrinsic to the operations of both English and Irish armies during the war. Furthermore, exposure to the war led to murder, rape and sexual violence toward women. The evidence, and that's the key, is the evidence that can be found suggests that was in somewhat lesser degree than was found in continental Ireland. Certainly, if you ever look at the kind of behaviour, the kind of activities you see in the little countries, it's just shocking stuff. It's appalling. Whereas in Ireland, you do see it, but not to the kind of extent that you see in continental Europe. There is a certain civilness about it, strangely, that you just don't find in the 30 Years' War, which comes soon after in continental Europe. But certainly not trying to suggest that it didn't happen. That's me. Thank you very much.
Thanks for a wonderful paper, and you know.